The First Crusade, Part 1. The People's Crusade and the arrival of the Knights. The First Crusade, of course, whose aim was to recapture the Holy Land, but to be more specific than that, defend Eastern Christians from Muslim aggression, to make pilgrimage to Jerusalem safer, and to recapture the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, among other things, are usually the discussion given for why the crusading army is going on the First Crusade. And I've done a previous podcast on reasons for crusades, which has all of them. There's a tremendous amount of background to this. But this one is just, we're just going to look at today, the First Crusade as it starts. As I said, there are two parts of it. The First Crusade, of course, is called by Pope Urban II, and you have the major knights, the leaders of the crusade, and then you have this People's Crusade. And they're all going to come a different direction. For example, if you look at the leaders of the knights, Godfrey of Bouillon is one of them. He's going to take the northern route, which will come in with the People's Crusade. You have Raymond of Toulouse, who's going to go from, obviously, Toulouse in France across the northern part of Italy, down the Yugoslavian coast, and then across northern Greece to Constantinople. You're going to have Robert of Normandy, who's going to go from Lyon down to Rome, and then across from Italy to the same area that Raymond of Toulouse went across. And then you have Bohemond of Toronto, who's going to leave from Toronto in the southern tip of Italy and cross the northern part of Greece to get into Constantinople. Now, they're all going to leave in 1096, and they will all arrive in 1097, but they won't all come in at the same time. So, now, this is the main body of crusaders. This is the group. These are almost all Franks. These are Norman noblemen from different parts of France and from the Norman holdings in Sicily and southern Italy. Okay, Raymond of St. Giles is referred to as the Count of Toulouse. One gentleman I had not mentioned previous to this was Admar of Montiel. Now, Admar is extremely important because he is the papal legate. He's also referred to as Bishop Le Pew. Now, as the papal legate, that means he's the Pope's representative on the expedition. So in questions of religion and control, he's powerful. I mean, he certainly is the number one religious leader, but he has the power to command the, I represent the Pope, we need to deal here. He's also a very good individual. It's just a shame that he's going to die about halfway through the First Crusade. I've already mentioned Bohemond of Toronto. Then there's Tancred, who is the nephew of Bohemond, who is considered one of the best fighters of the group. I mentioned Godfrey of Bouillon. And then there's another one, Stephen of Blois. Now, Stephen of Blois is what I refer to as the reluctant crusader. He didn't really want to go on the crusade, but he's married to William the Conqueror's daughter, Adela. And so to some extent, he's going to be pressured into going to represent the family. He's going to spend a great deal of his time looking for an opportunity to go home. And I may refer to him later on as Stephen the Chicken. It isn't that he isn't brave. It's just he's always looking for a way to go home. And it's going to hurt him later on. Okay, so these are knights. There aren't any kings here. These are noblemen, counts, dukes, etc. and so on. They have an entourage of forces. Excellent fighters, mounted horsemen for the most part, very Norman-style equipment, chainmail, so forth and so on. So that's going to be the main core of the Crusaders, but they're not going to get to Constantinople first. First people to get to Constantinople is the famous People's Crusade. This is about 20,000 just lower-class peasants who are going to get inspired by the various preachers. Now, the main preacher involved in the People's Crusade is Peter the Hermit. There's also another gentleman named Walter the Penniless. And there's also a German preacher named Gottschalk who will really stir the people up. Unfortunately, they're not going to do a whole lot of preparation. I mean, the knights that I mentioned before, they are collecting their train of equipment, their supplies, purchasing equipment, purchasing transportation, relatively well organized. The People's Crusade is quite frankly almost like a mob going through Central Europe to Constantinople. And they're going to be, you can imagine poor old Alexius, Emperor of the Byzantines, who will see this this group of characters descending and saying, "This is the crusading army?" This is not what he was thinking about. Part of the problem with this group is that, again, they do not have a lot of supplies. They believe that since they were on a mission from God or for God, that they would be kind of like fed manna in the desert, like the Israelites. And, of course, that didn't happen. So then the next thing they expected was when they advanced to a Christian city, they expected the people, out of gratitude for what they're going to do, to feed them. And that's not out of the realm of possibility. The problem is that there's a tremendous crop failure through the central part of Europe. There isn't a lot of food there to begin with. So when the food is not forthcoming, they will take it. And if that's not bad enough, the other thing is, at various places, Regensburg and other places along the route, some of these people killed Jews, burned them, stuffed them down wells. Said, "Hey, you know, as long as we're going to the Holy Land to fight the Muslims, hey, let's these people crucified Jesus, let's kill them too." Horrible atrocities. Believe it or not, there are some parts in Germany where the pogrom of killing the Jews was worse during this crusade than at some time during the Nazi era. There's at least one incident where you have the Jewish community going to the local bishop for protection, and the bishop grants the protection, and that doesn't make any difference at all. So it's pretty ugly. And then you have the camp followers that follow both armies, and that is the group that arrives in Constantinople in 1097. Now, this group, like I said, leaves from central Germany, goes down the Rhine River to Regensburg, and then through central Europe into Hungary, Austria, and then comes down in the northern Greece and then over to Constantinople. When they finally do arrive in Constantinople, the Alexius didn't want to let them into the city. He was afraid that if he let them into the city, that they would never leave or they would cause problems. So what he did was he shipped them across the Bosphorus to what is now the Turkish side of Asia Minor, and told them to encamp there. This is in August. Well, eventually this group can't wait. They end up preparing to march out to fight the Muslims. It actually happens in October of 1096. So that route that the People's Crusade took is also going to be the route, as I said before, of Godfrey of Bouillon, and he will follow a year after them. They believe that as a result of the preachers, Peter the Hermit, Walter the Penniless, that if you wore a special blessed cloth that had a cross in the middle of it, that Muslim arrows wouldn't hurt you. They believe that. Now they're going to put it to the test. So they march to the town of Nicaea and prepare to attack it. Well, the Muslims are they look at this ragtag group of people, and they're not impressed. and sally forth out of the city of Nicaea and just butcher the people's crusade. They just slaughtered thousands of them, and some were captured and sold into slavery. I believe Walter the Penniless is killed, but Peter the Hermit survives. And he's just stunned because he believed that, you know, if nothing else, they would get divine assistance. Oh, it's just terrible. And he did indeed spend the rest of his life in penance. He kind of locked himself away in a tower and did penance for the rest of his life for what he had done. Now, one of the downsides of what the People's Crusade had done is obviously they were going to give very bad press to the people in Central Europe, but it's also going to make the Muslims more overconfident. They're not going to have the respect for the Crusaders that they might have had these people waited until the real army was ready to go in 1097. And so that's going to be a little bit of a problem. It's going to also mean that it's going to be almost impossible to negotiate because you're not going to have that respect. Now, eventually, the first crusading army of knights will earn that, particularly after the Battle of Delorium. But we're not quite ready for that. So we've just started across the Crusades here. Hate to do, there's an awful lot yet to go. So I'm going to stop at this particular point, and on our next sojourn into the First Crusade, we'll go through the rest of it with the major knights, the battles, and so forth and so on. Now, as far as sources on this First Crusade, I have a lot of sources that you can choose. The do-all, be-all book is The History of the Crusades, Volume 1, by Stephen Runciman, R-U-N-C-I-M-A-N. Those are very expensive books, but they're the classic works on the subject. You should be able to buy used copies pretty reasonably. The Dream in the Tomb by Payne is an excellent book, which is an overall view of all the Crusades in a very readable fashion. And don't get me wrong, it isn't that it isn't scholarly, but it is in a position that anyone, even if you don't have any background to the Crusade, can pick this book up and understand it. Runciman's book is going to require a little previous pre-reading, shall we say. There is a history called The People of the First Crusade. There's one called The Atlas of the Crusades, and that's edited by Riley and Smith, and that is pictures, maps of all kinds of crusades, not just the numbered ones, but the various religious crusades. They also have a lot of categories that I would not necessarily, if all you're going to define a crusade as a holy war or a war of religion, well, you can see how much you can get involved. You can have a lot of different stuff, a lot of material in there, beautiful maps. And then I highly recommend The Arab Historians of the Crusades by Gabrielli. And what this is a list, it's a group of Arab historians' accounts from the time period that tell us their view. Now, the bad part about this is that for the most part, the Arab historians are interested in motivation and results. So they don't give us what a lot of us really like, and that is the killing and the battles and the great deeds and the famous people and so forth and so on. You know, the Richard the Lionhearted and Saladin. And this is a little bit more cold-hearted, but there are probably more surviving Muslim accounts of the Crusades, and certainly Crusader accounts. De Joinville and Villehardouin are is pretty much a classic work. They're bits and pieces from other people, but a lot of people didn't read and write. And a lot of people didn't come home, so it leaves us with pretty limited resources. So I highly recommend those. So that's all we have on the Crusades today. And don't forget to come by summahistorica.com, or you can use or type in History According to Bob. Both of them will get you to my website, which has the archives, and leave your comments and questions and all kinds of stuff like that. So stop by and see what's new. I try to upgrade it all the time. So thank you very much, and have a nice day.